can't help but think something is coming. You warned them, said Julian. The council. The day they decided to exile Helen and abandon Mark. The day they decided on the cold piece. You told them what the consequences would be. He leaned against the wall. I was only 12, but I remember it. You said, the fair folk have long hated the Nephilim for their harshness. Show them something other than harshness, and you will receive something other than hate in return. But they didn't listen to you, did they? They wanted their revenge, the council, said Magnus. They didn't see how revenge begets more revenge. For they sow the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. From the Bible, said Julian. He had not grown up around Uncle Arthur without learning more classic quotes than he'd ever know what to do with. But then there's a difference between revenge and vengeance, he added, between punishing the guilty and punishing at random. Justly we rid the earth of human fiends who carry hell for pattern in their souls. I suppose one can find a quote to justify anything, Magnus said. Look, I don't tattle to the Clave, whatever the warlocks of the Shadow Market might think to the contrary. But I've known Parapatai, dozens of them, what they're supposed to be like. And you and Emma are different. I can't imagine that if it hadn't been for the chaos of the Dark War, they would even have allowed you to go through with it. And now, because of a ceremony that was supposed to bind us forever, we have to figure out how to separate, Julian said bitterly. We both know it. But with the riders out there... Yes, said Magnus. You are forced together for the moment. Julian exhaled through his teeth. Just confirm something for me, he said. There's no such thing as a spell that cancels out love. There are a few temporary charms, said Magnus. They don't last forever. Real love and the complexities of the human heart and brain are still beyond the tinkering of most magic. Maybe an angel or a greater demon. So Raziel could do it, said Julian. I wouldn't hold your breath, said Magnus. Have you really looked all this up? Spells to cancel out love? Julian nodded. You are ruthless, said Magnus, even with yourself. I thought Emma didn't love me anymore, said Julian. And she thought the same about me. Now we know the truth. It's not just that it's forbidden by the Clave. It's cursed. Magnus winced. I wondered if you knew about that. Julian felt cold all over. No chance it was some kind of mistake of Jem's then. Not that he really thought it might be. Jem told Emma. But he didn't say exactly how it worked, what would happen. There was a slight tremor in Magnus's hand as he passed it over his eyes. Look up the story of Silas Pangborn and Eloisa Ravenscar. There are other stories, too, though the Silent Brothers do their best to keep it quiet. His cat's eyes were bloodshot. You go mad yourself first, he said. You become unrecognizable as a human being. And after you become a monster, you are no longer able to tell friend from enemy. As your family run toward you to save you, you will rip the hearts from their chests. Julian felt as if he were going to throw up. That? I never hurt my family. You won't know who they are, said Magnus. You won't know love from hate. And you'll destroy what's around you. Not because you want to, any more than a crashing wave wants to shatter the rocks it breaks on. You'll do it because you won't know not to. He looked at Julian with an ancient sympathy. It doesn't matter if your intentions are good or bad. It doesn't matter that love is a positive force. Magic doesn't take note of small human concerns. I know, Julian said. But what can we do? I can't become a mundane or a downworlder and leave my family. It would kill me and them. And not being a shadow hunter anymore would be like suicide for Emma. There is exile, Magnus said. His gaze was fathomless. You would still be shadow hunters, but you would be stripped of some of your magic. That's what exile means. That's the punishment. And because Parabatai magic is some of the most precious and most ingrained in what you are, exile deadens its power. All the things the curse intensifies, the power your runes give each other, the ability to feel what the other is feeling, or know if they're hurt, exile takes those away. If I understand magic, and I know I do, then that means exile would slow the curse down immeasurably. And exile would also take me away from the children, said Julian in despair. I might never see them again. I might as well become a mundane. At least then I could try to sneak around and maybe watch them from a distance. Bitterness corroded his voice. The terms of exile are determined by the Inquisitor and the Clave. It would be totally out of our control. Not necessarily, said Magnus. Julian looked at him sharply. I think you'd better tell me what you mean. That you have only one choice. And you won't like it. Magnus paused, as if waiting for Julian to refuse to hear it, but Julian said nothing at all. All right, said Magnus. When you get to Alicante, tell the Inquisitor everything. Kit? Something cool touched his temple, brushing back his hair. Shadows surrounded Kit, shadows in which he saw faces familiar and unfamiliar. The face of a woman with pale hair, her mouth forming the words of a song. His father's face, the angry countenance of Barnabas Hale. Ty looking at him through lashes as thick and black as the soot covering the London streets in the Dickens novel. Kit. The cool touch became a tap. His eyelids fluttered, and there was the ceiling of the infirmary in the London Institute. He recognized the strange tree-shaped burn on the plastered wall, the view of the rooftops through the window, the fan that spun its lazy blades over his head. And hovering over him, a pair of anxious blue-green eyes. Livy, her long brown hair spilling down in tangled curls. She exhaled a relieved sigh as he frowned. Sorry, she said. Magnus said to shake you awake every few hours or so, to make sure your concussion doesn't get worse. Concussion? Kit remembered the rooftop, the rain, Gwyn, and Diana. A sky full of clouds sliding up and away as he fell. How did I wind up with a concussion? I was fine. It happens, apparently, she said. People get hit on the head. They don't realize it's serious until they pass out. Ty? He said. He started to sit up, which was a mistake. His skull ached as if someone had taken a bludgeon to it. Bits and pieces of memory flashed against the back of his eyes. The fairies in their terrifying bronze armor. The concrete platform by the river. The certainty that they were going to die. Here. Her hand curved around the back of his neck, supporting him. The rim of something cold clicked against his teeth. Drink this. Kit swallowed. Darkness came down, and the pain went away with it. He heard the singing again, down in the deepest part of everything he'd ever forgotten. The story that I love you, it has no end. When he opened his eyes again, the candle by his bed had guttered. There was light, though, in the room. Ty sat by the side of his bed, a witch light in his hand, looking up at the rotating blades of the fan. Kit coughed and sat up. This time it hurt a little less. His throat felt like sandpaper. Water, he said. Ty drew his gaze away from the fan blades. Kit had noticed before that he liked to look at them, as if their graceful motion pleased him. Ty found the water pitcher in a glass and handed it to Kit. Do you want some more water? Ty asked, when Kit's thirst had emptied the pitcher. He'd changed clothes since Kit had seen him last. More of the odd, old-fashioned stuff from the storage room. Pinstriped shirt, black pants. He looked like he ought to be in an old advertisement. Kit shook his head. He held tightly to the glass in his hand. A strange sense of unreality had settled over him. Here he was, Kit Rook, in an institute, having gotten his head bashed in by large fairies for defending Nephilim. His father would have been ashamed, but Kit felt nothing but a sense of rightness, a sense that the peace that had always been missing from his life, that had made him anxious and uneasy, had returned to him by chance and fate. "Why did you do it?" Ty said. Kit propped himself up.
"Why did I do what?"
"That time I came out of the magic shop and you and Livy were arguing." Ty's gray gaze rested on the point around Kit's collarbone. "It was about me, wasn't it?"
"How'd you know we were arguing?" Kit said. "Did you hear us?"
Ty shook his head. "I know Livy," he said. "I know when she's angry. I know things she does. She's my twin. I don't know those things about anyone else, but I know them about her." He shrugged. "The argument was about me, wasn't it?" Kit nodded.
"Everyone tries to protect me," said Ty. "Julian tries to protect me from everything. Livy tries to protect me from being disappointed. She didn't want me to know that you might leave, but I've always known it. Jules and Livy, they have a hard time imagining that I've grown up, that I might understand some things are temporary."
"You mean me," Kit said, "that I'm temporary." "It's your choice to stay or leave," said Ty. "In Limehouse, I thought maybe it would be leaving."
"But what about you?" said Kit. "I thought you were going to the Scholomance, and I could never go there. I don't even have basic training."
Kit set his water glass down. Ty immediately picked it up and began turning it in his hands. It was made of milky glass, rough on the outside, and he seemed to like the texture. Ty was silent, and in that silence, Kit thought of Ty's headphones, the music in his ears, the whispered words, the way he touched things with such total concentration. Smooth stones, rough glass, silk and leather and textured linen. There were people in the world, he knew, who thought human beings like Ty did those things for no reason, because they were inexplicable, broken. Kit felt a wash of rage go through him. How could they not understand? Everything Ty did had a reason. If an ambulance siren blared in your ears, you covered them. If something hit you, you doubled up to protect yourself from hurt. But not everyone felt and heard exactly the same way. Ty heard everything twice as loud and fast as everyone else. The headphones and the music, Kit sensed, were a buffer. They deadened not just other noises, but also feelings that would otherwise be too intense. They protected him from hurt. He couldn't help but wonder what it would be like to live so intensely, to feel things so much, to have the world sway into and out of two bright colors and two bright noises. When every sound and feeling was jacked up to 11, it only made sense to calm yourself by concentrating all your energy on something small that you could master, a mass of pipe cleaners to unravel, the pebbled surface of a glass between your fingers.
"I don't want to tell you not to go to the Scholomance if that's what you want," said Kit. "But I would just say that it isn't always about people trying to protect you or knowing what's best for you or thinking they do. Sometimes they just know they'd miss you."
"Livy would miss me."
"Your whole family would miss you," said Kit.
"And I would miss you."
It was a bit like stepping off a cliff, far scarier than any con Kit had ever run for his dad, any downworlder or demon he'd ever met.
Ty looked up in surprise, forgetting the glass in his hands. He was blushing. It was very visible against his pale skin.
"You would?"
"Yeah," said Kit. "But like I said, I don't want to stop you from going if you want to."
"I don't," said Ty.
"I changed my mind." He set the glass down. "Not because of you. Because the Scholomance appears to be full of assholes."
Kit burst out laughing. Ty looked even more astonished than he had when Kit had said he'd miss him. But after a second, he started to laugh too. They were both laughing. Kit doubled up over the blankets when Magnus came into the room. He looked at the two of them and shook his head.
"Bedlam," he said, and went over to the counter where the glass tubes and funnels had been set up. He gave them a pleased look.
"Not that anyone here probably cares," he said, "but the antidote to the binding spell is ready. We should have no problem leaving for Idris tomorrow." Christina felt as if a tornado had blown through the room. She set her Bali song down on the mantel and turned to Mark. He was leaning against the wall, his eyes wide but not focused on anything. She remembered an old book she had read when she was a girl. There had been a boy in it whose eyes had been two different colors. A knight in the Crusades. One eye for God, the book had said, and one for the devil. A boy who had been split down the middle, part good and part evil. Just as Mark was split between fairy and Nephilim. She could see the battle raging in him now, though all his anger was for himself.
Mark, she began. It is not, don't say that it's not my fault, he said tonelessly.
I couldn't stand it, Christina.
It is not only your fault, said Christina. We all knew. It is all our fault. It was not the right thing to do, but we had very few choices. And Kieran did wrong you. I still shouldn't have lied to him.
A ragged dark crack across the plaster of Christina's wall bulged through the paint. It was the only sign of what happened. That and the crushed acorn on the hearth.
I am only saying that if you can forgive him, you should forgive yourself as well, she said.
Can you come here? Mark said in a strangled sort of voice. Mark had his eyes closed and was clenching and unclenching his hands. She nearly tripped getting to him across the room. He seemed to sense her approach. Without opening his eyes, he reached up for her and caught her hand in a bone-crushing grip. Christina glanced down. He held her hand so tightly it should have hurt, but all she saw was the red marks around both of their wrists. As close together, they had faded to almost nothing. She felt again what she had felt that night in the ballroom, as if the binding spell amplified their nearness into something else, a thing that dragged her mind back to that hill and ferry, the memory of being wrapped up in Mark. Mark's mouth found hers. She heard him groan. He was kissing her, hard and desperately. Her body felt as if fire was pouring through it, turning her light as ashes. Yet she could not forget Kieran kissing Mark in front of her, forceful and deliberate. It seemed she could not think of Mark now without thinking of Kieran, too. Could not see blue and gold eyes without seeing black and silver. Mark, she spoke against his lips. His hands were on her, stirring her blood to soft heat. This is not the right way to make yourself forget. He drew away from her. I want to hold you, he said. I want it very badly.
He let go of her slowly, as if the motion were an effort. But it would not be fair. Not to you, or Kieran, or myself. Not now.
Christina touched the back of his hand.
You must go to Kieran and make things right between you. He is too important a part of you, Mark.
You heard what the king said.
Mark let his head fall back against the wall. He'll kill Kieran for testifying. He'll hunt him forever. That's our doing.
He agreed to it. Without knowing the truth. He agreed to it because he thought he loved me, and I loved him.
Isn't that true? Christina said. And even if it wasn't, he didn't just forget that you fought. He forgot what he did. He forgot what he owes. He forgot his own guilt. And that is part of why he's so angry. Not at you, but at himself.
Mark's hand tightened on hers. We owe each other now, Kieran and I, he said. I have endangered him. The Unseelie King knows he plans to testify. He's sworn to hunt Kieran. Christina, what do we do?
We try to keep him safe. Christina said. Whether he testifies or not, the king will forgive him. We need to find a place Kieran will be protected.
Her chin jerked up as a realization hit her.
I know exactly where. Mark, we must...
There was a knock on the door. They stepped away from each other as it swung open. Both of them had expected it to be Kieran, and Mark's disappointment when it turned out to be Magnus was clear. Magnus was carrying two etched metal flasks and raised an eyebrow when he saw Mark's expression.
I don't know who you were waiting for, but I'm sorry I'm not it, he said dryly.
But the antidote is ready. Christina had expected a thrill of relief to go through her. Instead, she felt nothing. She touched her left hand to her sore wrist and glanced toward Mark, who was staring at the floor.
"Don't rush to thank me or anything," said Magnus, handing them each a flask. "Profuse expressions of gratitude only embarrass me, though cash gifts are always welcome."
"Thank you, Magnus," Christina said, blushing. She unscrewed the flask. A dark and bitter scent wafted from it, like the smell of pulque, a drink that Christina had never liked. Magnus held up a hand.
"Wait until you're in separate rooms to drink it," he said. "In fact, you should spend at least a few hours apart so that the spell can settle properly. All the effects should be gone by tomorrow."
"Thank you," said Mark, and headed for the door. He paused there and looked back at Christina.
"I agree with you," he said to her. "About Kieran. If there's anything you can do to guarantee his safety, do it."
He was gone noiselessly, with cat-soft footsteps. Magnus glanced at the cracked wall and then at Christina.
"Do I want to know?" he asked.
Christina sighed.
"Can a fire message get outside the wards you put up?"
Magnus stared at the wall again, shook his head, and said,
"You'd better give it to me. I'll get it sent."
She hesitated.
"I won't read it either," he said irritably. "I promise."
Christina set down her flask, found paper, pen, and steely, and scribbled the message with a rune signature before folding it and handing it to Magnus, who gave a low whistle when he saw the name of the recipient across the top.
"Are you sure?"
She nodded with a resolution she didn't feel.
"Absolutely."
Chapter 27 Ill Angels Only. "Emma," Julian rapped on her door with the back of his knuckles. At least he was fairly sure it was Emma's door. He'd never been inside her room at the London Institute.
"Emma, are you awake? I know it's late."
He heard her call for him to come in, her voice muffled through the thick wooden door. Inside, the room was much like his own, small with heavy blocks of Victorian-looking furniture. The bed was a solid four-poster with silk hangings. Emma was lying on the covers, wearing an overwashed T-shirt and pajama bottoms. She rolled onto her side and grinned at him. An overwhelming feeling of love hit him like a punch to the chest. Her hair was tied messily back, and she was lying on a rumpled blanket with a plate of pastries next to her. And he had to stop in the middle of the room for a moment to catch his breath. She waved a tart at him, cheerily.
"Ben Offey," she said. "Want some?"
He could have crossed the room in a few steps. Could have picked her up and swung her into his arms and held her. Could have told her how much he loved her. If they were any other couple, it would be that easy. But nothing for them would ever be easy. She was looking at him in puzzlement.
"Is everything all right?"
He nodded, a little surprised at his own feelings. Usually he kept better control over himself. Maybe it was the conversation he'd had with Magnus. Maybe it had given him hope. If there was one thing Julian's life had taught him, it was that nothing was more dangerous than hope.
"Julian," she said, setting the tart down and brushing the crumbs off her hands, "would you please say something?"
He cleared his throat. "We need to talk." She groaned and flopped back against her pillows.
"Okay, not that."
Julian sat down on the foot of her bed as she cleared off the covers, setting aside the food and a few things she'd been looking at. He saw an old photograph of a girl carrying a blade that looked like Cortana, and another one of four boys in Edwardian clothes by the side of a river. When she was done, she brushed off her hands again and turned a set face to his.
"How soon do we have to separate?" she said. Her voice was shaking a little. "As soon as the meeting is over in Alicante? What will we tell the kids?"
"I talked to Magnus," Julian said. "He said we should go to the Inquisitor." Emma made an incredulous noise.
"The Inquisitor? As in the council leader who enforces laws?"
"Pretty sure Magnus knows who the Inquisitor is," said Julian. "He's Alec's dad."
"Did he mean that as a sort of threat? Like, either we turn ourselves into Robert Lightwood, or he does it for us? But Magnus wouldn't..."
I can't see him doing that. He's much too loyal.
That's not it, Julian said. Magnus wants to help us. He remembers other Parabatai like us, and he pointed out that no Parabatai have ever gone to the Clave for help.
Because it's the Clave's law.
But that's not the problem, said Julian. We could handle the law. It's the curse which is the reason the law exists, even if the Clave doesn't know it. But we know it.
Emma only looked at him. Every other Parabatai have feared the law more than the curse, Julian said. They've always either separated, left the Clave, or hidden what was happening to them until they were caught or the curse killed them. Magnus said we'd be the first, and that would count for something with Robert. And he pointed out something else, too. Robert was exiled because he was in the Circle years ago. The exile temporarily suspended his bond with his Parabatai. Magnus said Alec told him about it, that it cut their bond enough that Robert didn't even realize his Parabatai was dead.
Exile?
Emma's voice shook.
Exile means the Clave sends you away. You have no choice about it.
But the Inquisitor is one who chooses the terms of the exile, said Julian. Robert is the one who decided Aleem could stay with Helen when she was exiled. The Clave was against it.
If one of us is to be exiled, it'll be me, said Emma. I'll go be with Christina in Mexico. You're indispensable to the children. I'm not.
Her voice was firm, but her eyes were glimmering with tears. Julian sensed the same wave of desperate love he felt before, threatening to overwhelm him, and forced it back.
I hate the idea of being separated, too, Julian said, running his hand over the blanket, the rough texture comforting against his fingers.
The way I love you is fundamental to me, Emma. So I am, no matter how far we are from each other.
The glimmer in her eyes became liquid. A tear spilled down her cheek. She didn't move to wipe it away.
Then?
Exile will deaden the bond, he said. He tried to keep his voice steady. There was still a part of him that hated the idea of not being Emma's Parabatai, despite everything, and hated the thought of exile, too.
Magnus is sure of it.
Exile will do something separation can't, Emma, because exile is deep shadow hunter enchantment.
The ceremony of exile lessens some of your Nephilim abilities, your magic, and having a Parabatai is part of that magic.
It means the curse will be postponed. It means we can have time, and I can stay with the kids.
I'd have to leave them otherwise. The curse doesn't just hurt us, Emma. It hurts the people around us. I can't stay near the kids thinking I might be some kind of threat to them.
She nodded slowly.
So if it gives us time, then what?
Magnus has promised to bring everything he has to bear on figuring out how to break the bond, or end the curse, one or the other.
Emma raised her hand to rub at her wet cheek, and he saw the long scar on her forearm that had been there since he'd handed her Cortana in a room in Alicante 5 years ago.
How we have left our marks on each other, he thought.
I hate this. She whispered. I hate the idea of being away from you and the kids.
He wanted to take her hand, but held himself back. If he let himself touch her, he might crumble and fall apart, and he had to stay strong and reasonable and hopeful.
He was the one who'd listened to Magnus, who'd agreed to this, and was on him.
I hate it too, he said. If there was any way it could be me going into exile, I would do it, Emma.
Look. We'll only agree to do it if the terms are what we want, if the exile period is short, if you can live with Christina, if the Inquisitor promises no dishonor will accrue to your family name.
Magnus really thinks Robert Lightwood is going to be that willing to help us? To basically let us dictate the terms of our exile?
He really does, said Julian. He didn't say why exactly, maybe because Robert was exiled himself once, or because his Parabatai died.
But Robert doesn't know about the curse.
And he doesn't need to, said Julian. Just being in love breaks the law long before the curse is triggered. And the law says we'll have to be separated or have our marks stripped away. That's not good for the Clave. They're hurting for shadow hunters, certainly ones as good as you. He'll want a solution that keeps you Nephilim pretty badly. And besides, we have leverage.
What leverage?
Julian drew in a long breath.
We know how to cut the bond. We've been acting like we don't, but we do.
Emma went rigid all over.
Because we can't even consider the idea, she said. It's not something we could ever do.
It still exists, Julian said. We still know about it. Her hand shot out and grabbed the front of his shirt. Her grip was incredibly strong.
Julian, she said, it would be an unforgivable sin to use whatever magic it is the Seelie Queen was talking about. We wouldn't just be hurting Jason, Alec, Clary, and Simon, all the people we don't know that we'd be harming, destroying this thing that's as fundamental to them as how you love me, and I love you.
They're not us, Julian said. This isn't just about you and me. This is about the children, about my family, our family.
Jules.
The dismay in her eyes was stark.
I've always known you'd do anything for the kids. We've always said we both would. But when we talk about anything, we still mean there are things we wouldn't do. Don't you know that?
Julian, you scared me.
Yes, I know that, he said, and she relaxed slightly. Her eyes were wide. He wanted to kiss her even more than he had before, partly because she was Emma, and that meant she was good and honest and thoughtful. Ironic, really. It's just a threat, he added. Leverage. We wouldn't do it, but Robert doesn't need to know that. Emma let go of his shirt.
It's too much of a threat, she said. Destroying Parabatai as a thing that exists could rip the whole fabric of Nephilim apart.
We're not going to destroy anything. He took her face in his hands. Her skin was soft against his palms. We're going to fix it all. We're going to be together. Exile will give us the time we need to find out how to break the bond. If it can be done the Seelie Queen's way, it can be done some other way. The curse was like a monster at our heels. This gives us breathing room. She kissed his palm.
You sound so sure.
I am sure, he said. Emma, I am totally sure. He couldn't stand it any longer. He pulled her into his lap. She felt her weight fall against his body, her face pressed against the crook of his neck. Her hand traced the collar of his T-shirt just where the skin touched the cotton.
Do you know why I'm sure? He whispered, kissing her temple, her cheek, where it tasted like salt. Because when this universe was born, when it blasted into existence in fire and glory, everything that would ever exist was created. Our souls are made of that fire and glory, of the atoms of it, the fragments of stars. Everyone's are, but I believe ours, yours and mine, are made of the dust of the same star. That's why we've always been drawn to each other like magnets, all our lives. All the pieces of us belong together.
He held her tighter.
Your name, Emma, means universe, you know, he said. Doesn't that prove I'm right?
She gave a sobbing half-laugh, lifted her face, and kissed him hard. His body jumped as if he'd touched an electrified wire. His mind went blank, just the sound of their breathing in his ears, and the feel of her hands on his shoulders, and the taste of her mouth. He couldn't stand it. Holding her, he rolled sideways, taking her with him so they lay crossways on the coverlet. His hands moved under her oversized shirt, cupping her waist, thumbs tracing the angles of her hips. They were still kissing. He felt raw, cut open, every nerve a bleeding edge of desire. He licked sugar off her lips, and she moaned. Everything about the fact that this was forbidden was wrong, he thought. Nobody belonged together more than he and Emma did. He almost felt as if their connection scorched its way through their parabatai marks, winding them closer, amplifying every sensation. Just his hand tangling in the soft strands of her hair was enough to make his bones feel as if they were turning to liquid, to fire. When she arched up against him, he thought he might actually die. And then she drew away, taking a long, shuddering breath. She was shaking. Julian, we can't. He rolled away from her. It felt like ripping off a limb. His hands dug into the blanket, gripping hard enough to hurt. Emma, he said. It was all he could say.
I want to, she said, raising herself up on an elbow.
Her hair was a mess of golden tangles, her expression earnest.
You have to know I want to. But while we're still Parabatai, we can't.
It won't make me love you any more or differently, he said, his voice hoarse. I love you, either way. I love you if we never touch.
I know, but it seems like tempting fate.
She reached to stroke his face, his chest.
Your heart's beating so fast.
It always does, he said, when it's you. He kissed her, a kiss that accepted that tonight there would be no more than kisses. Only you. No one but you. It was true. He had never desired anyone before Emma, and never anyone since. There had been times when he was younger that it had puzzled him. He was a teenager. He was supposed to be full of inchoate longings and wantings and yearnings, wasn't he? But he never wanted anyone, never fantasized or dreamed or longed at all. And then there had been that one day on the beach when Emma had been laughing next to him, and she had reached up to undo her barrette, and her hair had spilled down over her fingers and against her back like liquid sunlight. His whole body had reacted. He remembered it even now, the driving pain as if something deadly had struck him. It had made him understand why the Greeks had believed love was an arrow that tore through your body and left a blazing trail of longing behind. In French, falling in love was the coup de foudre, the bolt of lightning, the fire in your veins, the destructive power of 1,000,000,000 volts. Julian hadn't fallen suddenly in love. He always had been in love. He had only just that moment realized it. And after that he longed. Oh, how he longed, and wished for the time he'd thought he was missing something by not longing. Because the longing was like 1,000 cruel voices that whispered to him that he was a fool. It was only 6 months after their Parabatai ceremony. It had been the biggest mistake he'd ever made, and totally irrevocable. And every time he saw Emma after that, it was like a knife in his chest, but a knife whose pain he welcomed. A blade whose hilt he'd held in his own hand, pressed against his own heart, and nothing. And no one could have taken it away from him. Sleep, he said. He gathered her in his arms and she curled up against him, closing her eyes. His Emma. His universe. His blade. You see, Diana said, that's exactly what we thought it was. The silver-black moon shone down on Brosselin Forest as Gia Penhallow stepped out of the blighted circle of ashy trees and burned grass. As she did, the seraph blade in her hand blazed with light as if a switch had been flipped. She stepped back into the circle. The seraph blade went dark. I sent photos to Kieran, said Diana, looking at the consul's grim face. Kieran said these were the same kind of circles of blight he had seen in the Unseelie Lands. Most of what Kieran had recently seen in the Unseelie Lands had been inside of a cage. Gia shuddered. It is awful to stand inside this circle, she said. It feels as if the ground is made of ice, and despair is in the very air. These circles, Diana said, they are in the places that Helen and Aline said went dark on their map, aren't they? Gia didn't have to look. She nodded. I had not wanted to bring my daughter into this. If she and Helen can be present during the council meeting, they can speak up as candidates for the Institute. Gia said nothing. It is what Helen desperately wants, said Diana. What they both want. The best place to be is not always the safest. No one is content in a prison. Gia cleared her throat. The time it would take to have the council clear the request, portals to Wrangell Island are tightly regulated. The meeting would be over. Leave that to me, Diana said. In fact, the less you know, the better. Diana couldn't believe she had just said the less you know, the better to the consul. Deciding she was unlikely to come up with a better exit line, she turned and strode from the clearing. Drew dreamed of underground tunnels, split by roots like the bulging knuckles of a giant. She dreamed of a room of glittering weapons and a boy with green eyes. She woke to find the dim light of dawn illuminating her mantle, where a gold hunting dagger inscribed with roses pinned a note to the wood. For Drusilla. Thank you for all your help, Jaime. Sometime in the night, Kit woke, the Arazi softly burning on his arm. The infirmary was lit with warm, yellow light, and outside the window he could see the rooftops of London, sturdy and Victorian under the waning moon. And he could hear music. Rolling on his side, he saw that Ty was asleep on the bed next to Kit's, his headphones on, the faint sound of a symphony coming from them. A memory teased the edge of Kit's consciousness. Being very young, sick with the flu, feverish at night, and someone sleeping by the side of his bed. His father? It must have been. Who else could it have been but his father? But certainty eluded him. No, he wouldn't think about it. It had been part of his earlier life. He was someone now who had friends who would sleep by his bed if he was sick. For however long that lasted, he would appreciate it. The high doors of the sanctuary were made of iron and carved with a symbol Christina had known since birth, the four interconnected C's of Clave, Council, Covenant, and Consul. The doors opened soundlessly at a push onto a large room. Her spine tightened as she stepped inside, remembering the sanctuary and the Mexico City Institute. She had played there sometimes as a child, enjoying the vastness of the space. The silence, the smooth, cold tiles. Every institute had a sanctuary. "Kieran," she whispered, stepping inside. "Kieran, are you there?" The London sanctuary dwarfed the Mexico City and Los Angeles ones in size and impressiveness. Like a vast treasure box of marble and stone, every surface seemed to gleam. There were no windows for the protection of vampire guests. Light came from a number of witchlight torches. In the center of the room rose a fountain. In it stood a stone angel. Its eyes were open holes from which rivers of water poured like tears and spilled into the basin below. Words were inscribed around the base. Afante poropora de fluet aqua. A pure fountain gives pure water. Silvery tapestries hung from the walls, though their designs had faded with age. Between two large pillars, a circle of tall, straight-backed chairs were tumbled on their sides, as if someone had knocked them down in a rage. Cushions were strewn across the floor. Kieran stepped noiselessly out from behind the fountain. His chin was raised defiantly, his hair the darkest black Christina had ever seen it. Even the glare of the witchlight torches seemed to sink into it and vanish without reflecting off the strands. "How did you get the doors open?" Christina asked, glancing over her shoulder at the massive iron wedges. When she turned back, Kieran had raised his hands, open-palmed. They were scored all over with dark red marks, as if he had picked up red-hot pokers and held them tightly. Iron burns. "Does it please you?" Kieran said. He was breathing hard. "Here I am, in your Nephilim iron prison." "Of course it doesn't please me," she frowned at him. She couldn't help the small voice inside that asked her why she'd come. She hadn't been able to stop herself. She had been thinking of Kieran alone, betrayed and lost. Perhaps it was the bond between them, the one he'd spoken of in her room. But she'd felt his presence and his unhappiness like a whisper at the back of her mind until she'd gone to look for him. "What are you, Tumak?" he demanded. "Kieran," she said, "sit down. Let's sit down and talk." He only stared at her, watchful and tense, like an animal in the woods, ready to break away if she moved. Christina sat down slowly on the scattered cushions. She smoothed her skirt down, tucking her legs under her. "Please," she said, holding out her hand to indicate the cushion across from hers, as if she were inviting him to tea. He lowered himself onto it like a cat settling, fur ruffled with tension. "The answer is," she said, "that I don't know. I don't know what I am to Mark, or he to me."
"How can that be?" Kieran said. "We feel what we feel."
He gazed down at his hands. They were fairy hands, long-jointed, scarred with many small nicks. "In Hunt," he said, "it was real. We loved each other. We slept by each other's sides, and we breathed each other's breath, and we were never apart. It was always real. It was never false." He looked at Christina challengingly.
"I never thought that. I always knew it was real," she said. "I saw the way Mark looked at you."
She looped her hands together to keep them from shaking.
"You know Diego?"
"The very handsome, stupid one," Kieran said. "He's not stupid, not that it matters," Christina added hastily. "I loved him when I was younger, and he loved me. There was a time when we were always together, like you and Mark. Later, he betrayed me."
"Mark spoke of it.
In Faerie, he would have been killed for such disrespect of a lady of your rank." Christina wasn't entirely sure what Kieran thought her rank was.
"Well, the result was that I thought that what we'd had was never real. It hurt more to think that than it did to think that he'd simply stopped loving me. For I had stopped loving him that way, too. We'd grown out of what we had. But that is a natural thing and happens often. It is much more painful to believe that your love was always a lie."
"What else am I meant to believe?" Kieran demanded. "When Mark is willing to lie to me for the clave he despises."
"He didn't do it for the clave," said Christina. "Have you been listening to anything the Blackthorns have been saying? This is for his family. His sister is in exile because she is part fairy. This is to bring her back."
Kieran's expression was opaque. She knew family meant little to him in the abstract. It was hard to blame him for that. But the Blackthorns, in all their concrete realness, their messy and honest and total love for each other, did he see it?
"So do you no longer believe your love with the Rosales boy was a lie?" he said.
"It was not a lie," she said. "Diego has his reasons for what he's doing now. And when I look back, it is with pleasure at the happiness we had. The bad things can't matter more than the good things, Kieran."
"Mark told me," he said, "that when you went into Faerie, you were each made a promise by the Pooka who guards the gate, that you would find something you wanted there. What was it you wanted?"
"The Pooka told me I would have the chance to bring the cold piece to an end," said Christina. "It is why I agreed when it was decided to cooperate with the Queen."
Kieran looked at her, shaking his head. For a moment she thought he considered her foolish, and her heart sank.
He reached to touch her face. The glide of his fingers was feather-light, as if she'd been brushed by the calyx of a flower.
"When I swore fealty to you in the court of the Queen," he said, "it was to annoy and anger Mark. But now, I think I made a wiser decision than I could have imagined."
"You know I'll never hold you to that oath, Kieran."
"Yes, and that is why I say you are nothing like I thought you'd be," he said. "I've lived in this small world of the Wild Hunt and fairy courts, yet you make me feel the world is bigger and full of possibility."
He dropped his hand. "I have never known someone so generous in the heart." Christina felt as if her face were on fire.
"Mark is also all those things," she said. "When Gwyn came to tell us you were in danger in Faerie, Mark went to get you immediately, regardless of the cost."
"That was a kind thing to tell me," he said. "You've always been kind."
"Why do you say that?"
"Because you could always have taken Mark from me, but you didn't."
"No," Christina said. "It is as you told Adain. You would not want Mark's love if it did not come freely. Neither would I. I would not pressure or influence him. If you think I would, and that it would work if I did, then you don't know me at all,
nor Mark. Not as he really is. Kieran's lips parted. He didn't speak, though, because the sanctuary doors had opened, and Mark had come in. He was all in black and looked exhausted. The red ring around his wrist drew Christina's eye. Involuntarily, she touched her own wrist, the healing skin of the binding wound.
"I followed you here," he said to Christina. "There's still enough of the binding spell left to allow me to do that.
I thought you'd be with Kieran." Kieran said nothing. He looked like a fairy prince in a painting, remote, unassailable, distant.
"My Lord Kieran," Mark said formally, "can we talk?"
They looked like a painting, both of them kneeling, Christina's dark hair falling to hide her face. Kieran opposite her was a study in contrasts of black and white. Mark stood in the doorway of the sanctuary for a moment, just watching them, his heart feeling as if it were being compressed inside his chest. He really did have a thing for dark hair, he thought. At that moment he heard Christina say his name and realized he was eavesdropping. Coming into the sanctuary felt like entering a cold, harsh place. It was bound all around with iron. Kieran must have felt it too, though the look on his face gave no sign. It gave no sign he felt anything at all.
"My Lord Kieran," Mark said, "can we talk?"
Christina rose to her feet.
"I should go."
"You need not." Kieran had leaned back to lounge among the spilled cushions. Fairies did not lie with their words, but they lied with their faces and voices, the gestures of their hands. Right now, anyone looking at Kieran would think he felt nothing but boredom and dislike. But he hadn't left. He was still in the Institute. Mark clung to that.
"I must," Christina said.
"Mark and I are not meant to be near each other as the binding spell wears off." Mark moved closer to her, though, as she went to the door. Their hands brushed. Had he thought she was beautiful the moment he met her? He remembered coming awake to the sound of her voice, seeing her sitting on the floor of his room with her knife open. How grateful he had been that she was someone he had never known before the hunt, someone who would have no expectations of him. She looked at him once and was gone. He was alone with Kieran.
"Why are you here?" Kieran demanded. "Why lower yourself to come before someone you hate?"
"I don't hate you. None of this is because I hated you or wanted to hurt you. I was angry with you, of course I was. Can you understand why?"
Kieran didn't meet Mark's eyes.
"This is why Emma dislikes me," he said. "And Julian." Irloth whipped them both. The whipping he gave Emma would have killed a mundane human.
"I remember," said Kieran miserably, "and yet it seems distant."
He swallowed.
"I knew I was losing you. I was afraid. There was more to it as well.
Irloth had hinted you would not be safe in the Shadowhunter's world, that they were planning to lure you back, only to execute you on some trumped-up charge. I was a fool to believe him, I know it now."
"Oh," said Mark. The knowledge unfolded in him, realization edged with relief.
"You thought you were saving my life." Kieran nodded. "It makes no difference, though. What I did was wrong."
"You will have to make your own apology to Emma and Julian," said Mark.
"But for my sake, Kieran, I have forgiven you. You returned when you did not have to. You helped us save Tavi."
"When the Salt Refuge here was blinded by rage," Kieran said, "all I could think of was that you lied to me. I thought you'd come to the court to save me because you—"
His voice cracked.
"Because you loved me. I cannot bear to think on my own stupidity."
"I do love you," Mark said. "But it is not an easy or restful sort of love, Kieran.
Not like what you feel for Christina."
"No," said Mark. "Not like what I feel for Christina." Kieran's shoulders sagged slightly.
"I'm glad you admit it," he said. "I could not tolerate a lie now, I think. When I first loved you, I knew it was loving something that could lie. I told myself it would not matter.
but it matters more than I ever thought.
Mark closed the distance between them. He was half certain that Kieran would back away from him, but the other boy didn't move. Mark approached until there were only inches of space between them, until Kieran's eyes had widened, and then Mark knelt, cold marble against his knees. It was a gesture he had seen before, in the hunt and at revels, one fairy kneeling to another. Not submission, but an apology. Forgive me. Kieran's eyes were like saucers. It does matter, Mark said. I wish that I could not lie, so that you would believe me. All these days, I have not held back from affection with you because I was angry at you or sickened. I wanted you just as I did in the hunt, but I could not be with you, touch you, with all of its shadow by lies. It would not have felt true or honest. It would not have felt as if you were choosing me, because to make a true choice, we must have true knowledge. Mark, Kieran whispered, I do not love you as I love Christina. I love you as I love you, said Mark. He bent his head. I wish that you could see my heart. Then you would understand. There was a rustling sound. Kieran had sunk to his own knees, level with Mark. Would you have told me, he said, after the testimony? Yes, I couldn't have stood it otherwise. Kieran half closed his eyes. Mark could see crescents of black and silver beneath his lids, fringed by his dark lashes. His hair had paled to almost a pewter color. I believe you. He opened his eyes, looked directly into Mark's. Do you know why I trust you? Mark shook his head. He could hear the water rushing in the fountain behind them, reminding him of a thousand rivers they had ridden over together, a thousand streams they had slept beside. Because of Christina, said Kieran. She would not have agreed to a dishonorable plan. I understand you were trying to help your family, your sister. I understand why you were desperate, and I believe you would not have deceived me longer than you needed. Something behind his eyes suddenly seemed very old. I will testify, he said. Mark started up. Kieran, you don't... Kieran's hands came up to cup Mark's face. His touch was gentle. I'm not doing it for you, he said. This will be what I do for Emma and the others. Then that debt will be paid. You and I, our debts are paid already. He leaned forward and brushed his lips against Mark's. Mark wanted to chase the kiss, the warmth of it, the familiarity. He felt Kieran's hand come down to splay itself over his chest, over the elf bolt that hung there below his collarbone. We will be done with each other. No, Mark whispered. But Kieran was on his feet, the warmth of his hands gone from Mark's skin. His eyes were dark, his whole body tense. Mark shot to his feet after, meaning to demand that Kieran explain what he had meant by done, just as a terrible noise split the air. It was a noise that came from outside the Institute, though not very far at all, not nearly far enough. A memory flashed through Mark's mind of watching from horseback as a forest of trees was destroyed by lightning. Fire had flashed beneath him, the wrenching crash of branches and trunks like shrieks in his head. Kieran sucked in a breath. His eyes had gone distant, unfocused. They have come, he said. They are near. A crash ripped Emma out of sleep and out of Julian's arms. A crash that wasn't quite a crash. She thought at first that it sounded like two cars slamming into each other on the highway, the screech of brakes and the explosion of glass. It seemed to be coming from right outside. She bolted up and hurtled across the room to the window. There were five of them in the courtyard. They gleamed bronze in the morning light, both horses and riders. The steeds seemed metallic, their eyes bound with bronze silk, their hooves gleaming with a high polish. The fairies who sat astride them were just as shimmering and beautiful, their armor without visible jointures so that it looked like liquid bronze. Their faces were masked.
their hair long and metallic. Somehow, here in the heart of London, they looked far more terrifying than they had the first time Emma had seen them. Julian